This is one of Reverend Betty's Sundays off, so we have in her presence the Reverend Jan Knost, who will be delivering the sermon this morning. He brings a universalist perspective to his sermons, and they're always enlightening and thought-provoking. His sermon today deals with an issue that is not only timely, but it has generated a lot of conversation and controversy both locally and nationally. Reverend Knost was born in California to showbiz parents who were in opera production, and his father became a Universalist minister as well. He was educated at St. Lawrence University and did graduate work there and at Oxford, Brown, and Boston University. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Psychology and a Master of Divinity. He served in churches in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Texas. He's been a trustee of the UUA board representing the Mass Bay District. He's a member of the Ministerial Fellowship Committee and a member of the Continental Program Committee. He's married to Lorna for 50 years, bless her, and they have they have 4 children and 11 grandchildren. He's a published poet. He loves cooking, gardening, fly fishing in both fresh and salt water, golf, movies, and writing short stories. And yes, he still seeks to find the world's perfect martini. Welcome, Reverend Knost.
Let us share together a time of meditation and quiet reflection. For some of us, this is a time for reaching out beyond ourselves to that which we call God. For some of us, this is a time to reach within ourselves to our inner resources of strength and renewal. For some of us, this is a time for the quiet ordering of life. And for some of us, this is a time to search for meaning in a troubled world. May we be glad of the diversity of our prayers and meditations. May we rejoice in the richness of spiritual adventure that gives this meeting its power. So be it. Listening to Helene share her wonderful song and her story reminds me that great minds run in parallel, because the reading for this sermon on Breaching the Wall is a portion of an article by Charles Haynes, director of the Religious Freedom Education Museum in Washington, D.C. Roger Williams, as a religious dissenter, was verbally attacked before being banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1635 for objecting to the entanglement of religion and government that he believed corrupted both. He founded Rhode Island as the first government in history with no established religion and a commitment to protect liberty of conscience for every person. As a deeply religious minister, Williams vowed to put an end to centuries of oppression and coercion by erecting what he called a wall or hedge of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world. Rhode Island was to be a haven for the cause of conscience, where government stayed out of religion and all people, including Quakers, Catholics, Jews, and others, persecuted in surrounding colonies, would be free to choose in matters of faith. If he were alive today, there's little doubt that Roger Williams would be solidly in the corner of young Jessica Alquist of Cranston. He would view the school prayer banner in Jessica's high school as a blasphemous state appropriation of religion. You might think it would be easy to stand up for religious freedom in the birthplace of religious freedom, but apparently it isn't. Jessica has been taunted and threatened at school, targeted by an online hate campaign, and called an evil little thing by a state representative on the radio. But thanks to Jessica, the spirit of Roger Williams, America's first great dissenter, is alive and well in Rhode Island. Quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. First Amendment to the United States Constitution. During these beginning years of the third millennia, we are witnessing more and more stridency by the radical religious right. It has been going on for a while, but it was really escalated over the abortion controversy during the 1996 presidential election. Some of the most powerful lobbies in Washington are promoting a consciousness-raising crusade selling Christian salvation. As near as one can tell, though, God has not been brought into this process, which is just as well. God has always been a kind of shadowy walk-on, walk-off character in the melodrama of what has come to be known in some circles as the Jesus religion. What is at premium, however, is your soul and mine, or to be more specific, your freedom and mine. The object of the entire effort of right-wing evangelicals is to win converts. Their religio-political campaign is truly strident. It has brought about a strange phenomenon where millions of our fellow citizens have chosen to be silent. Protest against such stridency seems to have dried up. Questions involving the public accountability of congressional leaders is seldom heard, except with some of our television personalities, and I won't go into that. And so too, under the cover of a professed war on terrorism, there is a lot of religious mischief afoot in state and federal legislators. This morning, I'd like to address this issue and share some of my frustrations, at least, at its continuing to be a national problem. This frontal assault, which we seem to be hearing daily from the various primary candidates, is really an attack upon our constitutional rights as individuals. And we are in danger of losing some of the very important battles that most of us, particularly religious and political liberals and moderates, believe were fought and won many years ago. Politicians from the religious right, puffed up by their powers and smug in their self-righteousness, are determined to impose their agenda on you and me. In another instance, and despite overwhelming objections by the American public, right-wing conservatives in the House of Representatives went through with the impeachment of President Clinton. It was accomplished by a partisan Congress back in December of 1998. As closely as I have been able to determine, too, there were easily 70% of our fellow citizens who said they were opposed to such an impeachment. So it seems to me that we as a country are reaping the spoils of a generation of complacent citizenry. It has resulted from a dwindling number of Americans who even bother to go to the polls. In addition, there is the horrendous matter of campaign financing. The recent decision by the Supreme Court to allow unlimited campaign financing by corporations resulted in what are called political action committees, or PACs, to work their magic. And they do it in unlimited ways. And to me, it's ugly, scary stuff. And just to set the stage just a little bit more, let me remind you of the flap that continues up in Cranston, where this plucky little 16-year-old junior student, with the assistance of her dad and the ACLU, brought suit against the West Cranston School Committee for the continued existence of a school prayer on the wall of the school gymnasium, a prayer given as a gift by the class of 1963. It stayed there virtually unnoticed until Jessica, a professed atheist, said it was offensive to her because it began with the phrase, "Heavenly Father," and it ended with the word, "Amen." The lawsuit her father and the ACLU brought eventually to the federal court was that it was an unconstitutional invasion of the mandate for separation of church and state as directed by the First Amendment of the Constitution. And the beat goes on. Thankfully, at this time I was bringing this sermon together, the school committee, in fear of over $500,000 in legal fees, voted 5-2 not to appeal the federal decision. Now, I know there are those who hold the opinion that the ACLU often supports cases where civil rights are being threatened, either by government or circumstances, and we say to ourselves, how can they take that one on? But be assured that in most cases, if you will find that the ACLU continues to be consistent in protecting the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So we need to look a little more closely each time we disagree and give the situation a second look. Now, I know I may very well be preaching to the choir. You are a sophisticated congregation, much aware of the political process. But there is another aspect of reality which doesn't bode well for the future of our constitutional rights. And that is the double-edged sword of religious and political tolerance that we Unitarian Universalists celebrate long and long. We are tolerant of other people and their beliefs. Most probably, in some cases, it would seem to me, too tolerant. Those of us who share a strong belief in human rights, not to mention our respect for the integrity of the individual, are less likely to become concerned when someone from another belief begins to make noises in the background. It's their right, we insist, to express their beliefs and live their lives accordingly. Well, yeah. Trouble is that there is a growing segment of our population not so tolerant. There are those who believe it is their God-given right to impose their way of life upon the rest of us. And since the early 1980s, they have used their political clout to gradually take control of more than half the state legislatures in at some point in time, both houses of Congress. Today, all you have to do is listen to the interminable debates of the candidates for president to see this tendency writ large. One recent columnist in the Provident Journal wrote of it, "Will someone please put a tent over this circus?" Now, how did this happen? Very simply, actually. A small group of activist fundamentalists succeeded in turning the Southern Baptist Convention into a political machine. I witnessed it happening during my ministries in San Antonio and Houston. It was a complete reversal of that denomination's deep-seated understanding of church-state separation, as articulated by Roger Williams and today's American Baptist Church, not Southern Baptist Church. That same group who engineered the Southern Baptist takeover became deeply involved in the religious rights support for right-wing candidates. They followed the founding of Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority and its successor, Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition. These admittedly shrewd right-wing operatives and others working in the background turned both these organizations into what were actually illegal political action committees. So between 1988 and 1992, both Falwell and Robertson lied to the public about their intentions and the use of their tax-free wealth for political purposes. The infant movement gained its zenith in the 92 Republican Convention in Houston when Pat Buchanan declared the religious rights holy war, that's jihad in today's terms, in America. For nearly 50 years, I have tried to pursue a religious profession that celebrates the spiritual life of human beings. I am not opposed to religion. But when Pat Buchanan explained the lines of his holy war, I frankly began to become very frightened. What really concerned me was that that platform being then announced would reverse nearly all the civil rights legislation of the 60s and 70s. That platform today simmers with undercurrents of bigotry and prejudice. The ultimate goal is clear. The agenda says it wants to get the government off our backs. It wants to give big business special benefits while at the same time inserting government controls into private life. From the bedroom, to the schoolroom, to the workplace, to the public square, and even into our television set and home computer, and now to the control of women's lives. They want to control how one lives and how one dies. I am reminded of an extremely scary novel by Margaret Atwood published in the 70s titled The Handmaid's Tale. Check it out. Let's start with the issue of school vouchers. The religious right wants to give vouchers to a few kids in so-called failing public schools to allow their parents to opt to enroll them in nearby private schools. But if the standard of grading is gradually raised for public schools, then more and more public schools will fail. One of the ultimate goals is to abolish public school education and its system and give each student in the states where it is voted a voucher for a designated amount of tax dollars, your tax dollars, each year. It can be used in any public school or parochial school or be spent by the parents if the student is what they call homeschooled. The ultimate cost, if this continues for taxpayers, would be horrendous. There are also school prayer bills waiting to be voted in a number of state legislators. They want to allow prayers in every public school during the regular school day and public events, including sports events. Such legislation, my friends, will permit students to evangelize fellow students, to entice classmates into clubs and other organizations disguised as recreational groups with a clear intention of religious conversion. Okay, what else might they have in mind? Here's one that might surprise you. It is a delusion called parental rights. It will permit fundamentalist Christian parents to interfere with the curriculum of public schools by demanding that creationism be given equal voice with evolution in science classes. Certain books they feel are offensive will be censored or eliminated from the classroom and the libraries. Health education classes will be forbidden when they teach matters dealing with birth control, abortion, or any dating practices beyond what they call total abstinence. Obviously, the religious right is determined to abolish women's right to reproductive choice. The pressure is subtle in many ways, requiring teenagers to get parental permission to have abortions, or listing doctors who perform abortions in a public register, even if they rarely perform such procedures. And then there's the whole issue of mandated vaginal sonograms for those who seek abortions. And they also want to incorporate a sort of charitable choice element into social welfare in various states. What this means is that religious groups will be encouraged to enter into the social welfare mainstream. President Bush's faith-based initiative is a federal expansion of that same concept. Though some good may come of such plans if made available to all religious groups, social conservatives continue to keep pressure on the federal legislators so that only the right charities could receive such aid and assistance. So it goes. One thing after another comes on their legislative agendas, asking for ever tightening controls. Overall, the rights of individual citizens are in jeopardy if issues are not watched and taken seriously. We need to be intentional when such threats come on the horizon. Some even want to oversee America's love life, requiring couples to submit to religious counseling before they can marry or divorce. They want to make homosexuality in any form a crime. The ultimate result of all this will be a society in which women are less equal than men, single parents are looked upon with disdain, immigrants are denied social services or help in adjusting to American life and language, and gays and lesbians are sentenced to lifetimes of discrimination and eternal damnation. This is the life they envision for you and me. Be not mistaken. Living in what has often been referred to as liberal New England, many may insulate us from threats that the people of states like Texas and Florida feel all the time, but the possibility is there. I want to conclude with a beacon of hope. The result of my doing so will be to charge you with ongoing vigilance in the year ahead, a vigilance that recognizes the subtle efforts to limit personal freedoms and civil rights by those in political power. I suspect that only a tiny minority of American students of history can properly identify the most well-known of the Bill of Rights. Those first 10 amendments of the Constitution constitute an inspiring document in totality. They should stand sacred in the minds and hearts of every citizen, but the most important of those rights is the very first one. Congress shall make no law respecting religion or prohibiting the established free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. In case after case, over the decades of America's history, the United States Supreme Court has carefully protected that wall of separation between church and state, intimated in the First Amendment. But these days it's changed. That noble testament to human freedom is under fire. And though I know that some of our presidential candidates will assure us that they will in all cases carry out the law, but perhaps only as they interpret the law. So be vigilant, my friends. Pay attention. Read the various watch journals that let us know when such mischief is on the horizon. Paste the names and addresses of your state and federal representatives in your refrigerator and enter their email addresses on your computers. President Thomas Jefferson stated that of all the things he was proud to have accomplished in his political life was the statute in Virginia for religious freedom, which he wrote and saw passed into law. And so, as your motto, you might take the second step and memorize his stirring words that he used to justify that document. Here's what he said. I have sworn on the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of humanity. To close, I'd like to share a conversation that took place some time back on the ACLU network with former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. During an interview marking his 80th birthday, he was asked, what has been happening back home in America that gives you most concern? This was his answer. Religion, too little knowledge of history, too little respect for diversity, too much talk of accommodation, people so sure they've seen the divine light that they want the government to make everyone else see it that way too. Justice Black continued, there was nothing more important to the framers of the Bill of Rights than the subject of religious freedom. They knew that religious differences can lead to hatred and persecution that can tear a country apart. What I don't understand, I can't understand, is how people in America can look at what is happening in the rest of the world, where people are killing each other because of religious differences, and then chip away at the constitutional rights that were put there for the very purpose of avoiding these problems. And he concluded, they gave us something new, a written guarantee of religious freedom, and they enforced that freedom by requiring that government and religion to be separate, that government couldn't support any religion or all religions, whether through taxes or prayers or giving money to religious schools or putting the stamp of approval upon any particular religious faith. One last observation. Sometime back, The following quotation was made public. It said, "The country is governed for the richest, for the corporations, the land speculators, and the exploiters of labor. The majority of humanity are working people. So long as their fair demands, the ownership and control of their livelihoods, are set at naught, we can have neither men's nor women's rights. The majority of humanity is ground down by industrial oppression in order that the small remnant may live in ease." Those words were written by one Helen Keller. I hope, my good friends, that I have stirred you to a modulated anger that will result in action in the weeks and months ahead. God knows our country needs such patriots. So be it. These words were written by William Henry Channing. "To live content with small means, to seek elegance rather than luxury, and refinement rather than fashion, to be worthy, not respectable and wealthy, not rich, to listen to stars and birds, babes and sages with open heart, to study hard, to think quietly, act frankly, talk gently, await occasions, hurry never. In a word, to let the spiritual, unbidden and unconscious, grow up through the commonplace. This is our symphony." So be it.